Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 97, being recorded on the 7th of October, 2015, with special guest Kathleen Wilson. I'm Sujit Mello, and on Skype with me, I have Evan Basilik and our special guest. Now, Kale is running a little late. He said he might join, so we'll get him whenever he joins the show. But Evan, it was nice to meet up with you over lunch today.
Yeah, that was just for our audience. I'm up visiting my folks, and as it turns out, I emailed Sujit and said, "Hey, I'm in New Jersey. You know, any chance we're anywhere nearby?" Turns out, you know, you work 10 minutes up the street from where my folks live. So it was nice to meet you in person. Nice to meet in person for only the second time.
That's right.
But to have a nice casual lunch. So yeah. But Kale, that's probably why Kale's late today. He's mad that we got to hang out.
He's bummed. I know that. Yeah. Anyway, in terms of updates to the Azure space, this one, I guess it kind of, there's a couple. Okay. The one that hits home for me, at least, I originally came from India, and very happy that Azure is now available in three regions in India. That impressed me quite a bit that they have three data centers in one country. That doesn't happen very often. And is it because of the demand, sheer demand for stuff in India? Why would they need three data centers out there? Evan, any background on that?
I think that's a huge market. And then on top of that, and this is just Evan's opinion, right? I don't have any magical insight into the marketing and some of the decisions about where we bring this stuff up. But from what I've heard and seen, going big into India was our opportunity to kind of get ahead of our competition, right? Because I believe that we are the first cloud service, first of the major cloud services to have local data centers in India.
Right. Okay. I was just impressed that they would have three of them. I mean, I understand one or maybe two, but three seem like a lot. And it's good, though. I know that my family over there, they use Azure for some of their businesses, and they're using the data center out in Singapore, which is the only one that was available in that region now. So it's good that they have something available in India itself. Good. I think that's about it, right? Evan, you put a video for the Azure data center?
Yeah, and I'll, full disclosure for our audience, I totally swiped this link from you. this is the link you sent out to one of our internal discussion analysts on a video about our data centers and the different, generations and the history and the power uses, which I actually had not seen that particular video. And so I thought that was a really good one for people to check out to really see what these things look like. I mean, I don't know what other people envision, but, I still have in my head kind of old school racks, right? And that's nothing what it looks like today.
It is a slick video.
Highly recommend people check it out.
I was surprised that they provided that level of detail and insight into these data centers. A lot of it is supposed to be very secretive, but I guess they want to show the world that, there's no magic around here. It's all technology. So,
I do think one of the things I know, and I can't remember where I saw this, but I believe that some portions, if not major portions of these designs, are actually pushed out as standards now.
They're referenced
as public standards to try and drive the industry in the direction of lower cost consumption, lower power consumption, all that kind of stuff. Because at the end of the day, that stuff's wasted money, even for you know, us, I mean, we want to spend our money on the software and the technology on it. Nobody wants to spend it on hardware. You have to, and energy, you have to, but, you know, it's just good for the world and good for the industry to publish that stuff.
Absolutely. So, yeah, and there was also a companion video that I found. Not only a video, it's like a website where you get a 3D view of the data center and you can zoom in and you can kind of, it's like playing a game, you know. you can walk through the corridors and see what's in each of the rooms, and, you know, it's kind of an interesting way to view the data center. We'll put a link to that in the show notes, though. So thanks for that, Evan. All right, let's give our guest, Kathleen Wilson, a chance to introduce herself. Kathleen, I know I just I guess we'll just mention that Kathleen's on a slightly lagged internet connection, so it might take her a little while to respond from time to time, but she's out there. Kathleen, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you very much, Sujit and Evan. I met you guys virtually. We do work at the same organization. I work at Microsoft, and I was able to present to the Azure community a little bit about the work that I do at Microsoft. And what I'm focusing right now at Microsoft is assisting customers on the human, like the people and process aspects of adopting and managing and operating Azure. Because, as you know, some people do see cloud computing, especially if you're an IT pro, it can be seen a bit as a threat, or it's like, what am I going to do now? So I work in the data center and cloud center of excellence. I'm based out of Toronto, Canada, so you might notice that in my accent when I say things like process. And I develop a lot of offerings focused. My two main areas of focus have been DevOps. And of course, we have a great story around DevOps with Microsoft's Azure, and as well as, you know, how do I structure and change my organization to manage infrastructure as a service or platform as a service, leveraging Microsoft Azure, of course. So some of the things, you know, that I found, you know, early back in the day when I was in Microsoft Consulting Services as a consultant, I worked on the private cloud TAP for System Center 2012. And you know, the things in the cloud world change, and specifically, you know, your on-premise help desk or service desk, you know, people don't call up and say, hey, I need some compute resources in your private cloud or in Azure, help me out. But again, another organization, so you don't want to expose the WAP portal, you know, to the organization, right? Because, you know, applications, you know, everybody's just going to go mad and start consuming like mad, and you need to put some checks and balances in place. And also manage, you know, especially with Azure's like subscriptions, who's able to subscribe, you know, talk about service brokerage, service integration, like, you know, what are our corporate policies of what can go in the cloud and what must remain on premise? And, you know, a lot of these things are a lot of the questions after, you know, we go and explain and get people connected up to Azure and they're like, okay, great. How do I continue moving forward? And, you know, we found a lot of customers struggle with that. Even, you know, even internally at Microsoft, you know, a lot of stuff, I spent a lot of time talking to the folks in MSIT. You know, we're moving like, you know, thousands of applications into Azure, you know, and we, you know, we thought, okay, lift and shift, we'll do just, you know, lift a virtualized servers on-premise and put them into infrastructure as a service. And there's so many ramifications when you look at subscription management.
I was going to say, that's huge. I mean, that's kind of the what I find is that's the one that sounds really good on a marketing slide. And the concept is absolutely there. It's like everything. It's like migrating your application from server A to server B, right? It sounds really easy, but when you go to do it, there's all these little things that you realize you didn't write down. You know, or you don't have the install for that, you know, it sounds easier than it is, but you're right. The internal folks, even at Microsoft, struggle with it. So how did you, like, so what have you guys learned that kind of is making a difference when you talk to folks talking about that?
Well, and it's really, you need to take a bimodal IT approach to it, right? You can't take your legacy on-premise practices and try to perform them in the cloud. So let's think about, you know, you're moving that, you know, that application or service from on-premise. It's like, you know, somebody did, you know, manage the hardware, somebody managed the network, you know, somebody managed compute, you know, these roles now change, right? Because they were three different organizations when it was on-premise. Now we move it into the cloud, and then we, you know, the IT pros are being moved up a layer on the stack. It's like, okay, you're just managing, you know, if it's infrastructure and service, you're managing virtualized compute in our cloud, not on-premise, right? So, you know, you need to still work with the people in networking on-premise to, you know, kind of understand that. So what we try to do is start looking at, you know, models where we say, okay, you know, these are the roles, and we use the Cloud Services Foundation reference model. And if you go to aka.ms/, and I believe, let me check, it's CSFRA. We use that reference architecture, and we really looked at, you know, okay, there's certain capabilities that the cloud must have. You need to have automation. And, you know, I was listening to a lot of your earlier podcasts, so I knew what to expect. It's like, you know, a lot of, if it's not written down, it's very hard to automate. So we kind of work with Absolutely. The customers, like, okay, how do you know, you like, a lot of people is like, can, you know, Azure automation do this? Yes. It's like, how long is a piece of string? You know, what do you need it to do? Well, I'm not sure. It's like, well, let's start from when somebody requests compute in the cloud, right? Do you have business approvers? Right? Do you need to do that type of approval? You know, how do you charge back applications in your organization? That really leads to subscription management, because it's like, how do I want to see my bill in the end of the day? And customers struggle with giving a bill to the business on-premise. The cloud makes it a little bit more difficult as well, because now we still have to charge them for on-premise components, but how do I manage my subscription in the cloud? You know, is it by business unit? Are you doing it by application? Like, how, do you do chargeback? Do you do just showback, right? My recommendation is go to the cloud, just do showback for a while, right? So you get people to understand what the bill is going to look like, and they don't get the sticker shock.
So just to be clear, so by showback, it sounds like you mean, well, you'll tell people this is, you know, this is what your consumption cost, but you're not actually, you know, doing the internal cost, the internal transactions to move the money from, you know, department A to department B, right? So it's just really showing them what they consumed, right?
Yes, but Evan, you've worked with other customers too. It's like, usually in there, you're moving an application, right? And yep. The application has a business owner, and it's very easy. It's like, here's your bill, right? Or this is what you get. So if you get the subscription management right, you can say, okay, you know, this is accounting department's application. This is what it's costing you to compute, you know, do the end-to-end in Azure, right? So kind of understand that. It's like, I find a lot of customers are, they're not necessarily lifting and shifting specific VMs. We start getting into the conversations about applications. They're like, well, who owns this application? What does it do?
Yeah, I think you talking about this reminds me of, you know, because I do a lot of evangelization of Azure inside Microsoft as well, because I've, you know, been in this space for forever. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with somebody who walked up to me and said, hey, I saw this talk you did internally, and, you know, our team's really interested in moving to Azure. You know, we want to go, but we need to figure out how much it would cost us if we go. And I said, well, you know, your compute's going to dominate your cost, and this is kind of what compute costs, and, you know, this is what a typical server would cost that runs SQL Server, or, you know, one that runs IIS, and all that kind of stuff. And they came back and said, well, but, you know, man, that sounds really expensive. I said, well, how much are you paying for your app today? 2.5 months later, they came back and said, we can't figure it out, and nobody knows. Because there's just, you know, it's just that somebody gave them some virtual machines that are in an on-premises data center somewhere, and I'm sure that their larger department, you know, writes a check to some other internal larger department But at a, you know, an application layer, there is absolutely no transparency to it. So when you guys go on the, you know, you're talking about doing the show back and do you do chargeback, do you, how do you address that kind of initial sticker shock where now that, that cost that used to be abstracted and it was this big, you know, dollar amount that the R&D department gives the IT department or something like that into something that really hits at the application owner level? And do you find that that drives a different conversation when they actually are aware of that stuff?
Yeah, because, you know, I was lucky to participate in a very large call with a very large organization that, you know, that moment in time between IaaS and PaaS was like minutes, right? Because, you know, we do this thing called service views, right? So we go in and we actually decompose an application and talk about all the components needed to, you know, deliver a service. And, you know, the customer is saying, right, it's like, well, I have 5 SQL VMs. And, you know, they kept giving this app, you know, app name. And I'm like, well, what does it do? And they're like, well, we don't know. And I'm like, obviously, we don't have the right people in the room. We're missing some people because we need the developers, right? So you need to make sure you got, like, developers in the room. You got the consumers or a representative of the consumer of the service. And that could be a business analyst too, right? It doesn't necessarily need to be like the whole R&D department. I mean, like, that's it. And then you need the people who manage the infrastructure. Because, you know, when we started talking to them, it became very apparent. It's like, well, you have 5 SQL VMs. And if we lift and shift them and put them into infrastructure as a service, and, you know, they're only doing periodic billing or reporting, wouldn't that be better to replatform that as platform as a service? Because then you're only renting the time. Because fully loaded costs of VM, we're not even taking into account, and I bet a lot of people aren't, is the actual on-premise data center costs, the fully loaded costs of the employee. Let's talk about licensing costs, right? Network charges. You know, HVAC, like there's a whole bunch of things that go into the actual compute. And that's like, it's that balance between, okay, these are my consistent standard line items to deliver this service. And then there's a variable. And then that's the scary part, I think, in Azure, right? Is that variable of compute. But there was always variable on premise too. There's always variable on
premise. You just didn't really know it. Yeah.
Yes, because we didn't sit down and we talked about components, and here we're trying to do is, you know, abstract and lead in with the why and the what first before we go into the how. Because, you know, we could talk, you know, there's many ways to carve up a subscription at the end of the day or a bill to charge back. But at the end of the day, it's better to go in knowing that it's like at the end of the day, we charge back a business unit. So if we're going to put any of their compute into Azure, we will need to use this subscription, this resource group, and manage it this way so I can actually pull a report out and give them a bill, right? Or show them a bill. And I think a lot of times when we did things on premise and then we moved to virtualization, we were trying to stop those, you know, underutilized servers. So we kind of like ran everything together, and then it, you ask somebody, it's like, well, you know, does this server deliver my service? Does this, you know, router, is this part of the service? The idea is now starting out with like, let's decompose a service from an element, understand the, you know, the end-to-end service. And I still don't think we're going to get a lot of customers in the first year getting a really great bill to the organization. I don't think they're going to do, but I think now that they're actually understanding the peaks and the valleys and how it's paid for, I think they'll have a better conversation moving forward about what it costs.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And the cost is ultimately what drives the business, right? I mean, that's what drives some of the decisions they make about how they're going to implement something or what components they're going to use and, you know, how much they invest in changing the code to use a lower cost component, you know, things like that.
No, Kathleen, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And I just wanted to, I was reminded about, you know, we've had vendors on the show before, and I was trying to recall, we had somebody on the show that talked about, it may have been a company called Cloud Cruiser. They have, And there are other companies like this that basically add, monitoring applications on top of Azure that can monitor exactly where the costs are going and how to optimize those costs. I mean, is that something that you've dealt with?
Yeah, well, we were before you actually implement the technology as understanding is we actually draw out what we call like a service map, and other companies will be called service view. It's actually a visual representation of a service.
Okay.
Right? And if you think about the ops manager days when you used to, well, and we still do this for customers a lot, is distributed applications, you know, monitoring the endpoints,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, from a transaction base. So if you look at it, it's like, well, I got to draw a picture of what everything's in there. And then I need to actually now instrument and create a management pack with multiple different, like a management pack bundle with lots of different management packs to actually monitor end to end. I recommend customers to do that because, like, Cloud Cruiser's great, but can we take it to another level? Because the biggest thing that we're trying to do is, like, the cloud, we've got people out there selling cloud. The cloud's going to make you better. It's going to make you faster. It's going to make you more efficient. And if we don't start thinking about those things that we struggled on-premise with and mm-hmm. address them before we move to the cloud, we're lifting and shifting the issues we had on premise, and we're just putting it in the cloud.
True.
So yeah, understanding like things like Apptio, which does, you know, charge back, bill back, it can actually show you what you're consuming, or Cloud Cruiser. You know, these are things that are really great, but still need to have that conversation before we actually, you know, plunk it and instrument it. It's like, who's going to pay that bill, or are you going to pay that bill?
Now, you made an interesting comment earlier about how you would reconsider replatforming an application as a PaaS application instead of just a lift and shift IaaS application. How do you make that determination in terms of, you know, because obviously replatforming itself is probably a huge cost to it, right? Very often the entire application has to be rewritten, or many parts of it have to be rewritten if you replatform it as a PaaS offering. How would a customer make that determination if that's what the effort?
Yeah, well, it's most of the time what happens is the customer's like, okay, I got to get this out of my aging data center and I got to move it. So we do the lift and shift of, you know, infrastructure as a service or IaaS first. Then through these lovely people that we have in Premier Resources, you know, they go in and help the customer afterwards with the, you know, we have ADMs, so they're focused on application development. They know lifecycle management and everything. And they, you know, they go in through the under Premier contracts and they work the customers to help them replatform applications. Right? Some are easier, you know, the database layer, like if we're talking about SQL, Azure SQL, you know, it's easier to decouple that database from the main app. But really, a lot of customers, and I'm sure both of you have seen that, is that, you know, lifecycle management didn't work really, really well on on-premise world. And then, you know, platform as a service, that cost to repurpose that application, if you think about it, it's like, now I'm managing higher up on the waterline. You know, I'm not patching VMs, right? I'm just mm-hmm. managing an application. And there's lots of scenarios. Like, in the last 6 months, I've seen 3 customer bids come in for Azure when these were the developers. We weren't even talking to the infrastructure folks. We weren't even pitching to infrastructure folks. This was a crazy shift for me. I don't know, Evan, Sujet,
I've absolutely seen that on my side, where, you know, you literally get from the ground up, right? Because it's somebody that wants their app and they're saying, I can't get it into my own data center, you know, so you know what, I'm going to try this cloud thing, and oh, I just need to put in a credit card and I can, you know, I can go try something, right? And you see that on bigger scale too for companies that kind of have distributed stuff. The other thing, and you know, not to go back too far, but you made the comment about lifecycle management. There's a joke that we have on some of the support teams that I've worked on, where, you know, a lot of customers that we run into, their version of lifecycle management is they ship the app, you know, it's on this OS, this build of .NET, this version of SQL Server, and then everybody backs away and says, no, don't touch it. That is literally the plan for the next, you know, 5 years, right? Just don't touch it. Nothing will change, which it always does, and nothing will break, so.
Well, I got into a call where there was a customer still running one of their mission-critical applications on Fox Pro.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And they're talking about going to Azure, and we're actually putting the effort in of, like, rebuilding that application to get them off the Fox Pro. This is, we're talking about a multi-million dollar application run on Fox Pro. And to go back to, Evan, you made that credit card comment.
Yeah.
Azure, if you're in an IT pro or if you're focused on infrastructure, this is the last kick at the can for you to become the service provider that the organization demands. Because platform as a service, it can be a scary thing. It's like you need to start looking at, it's like, how do I shift my role? How do I become more service oriented? How do I become more outcome, business outcome focused versus watching blinking lights? And I mean that with love and cookies all out there, but it's really, it's like, if you are, you know, working on premise and managing blinking lights, it's like, there's some really great things to do in Azure. It's like, why wouldn't you want to manage higher up the stack? I don't know. That would be me, right?
True. So Kathleen, what are some of the, like, if you were to name one or two biggest blockers that you may have seen with customers that would block them from going to the cloud, what would that be?
It's the people. 90% of all IT projects, whether or not they're on-premise or in the cloud, and I can't see your faces, but I bet you're nodding your heads right now. If you don't sell it to the on-premise folks or the people in the organization that this is a good thing, that cultural shift will not happen. Mm. It's like, what's in it for me, right? What's in it for me? You know, we go through reorgs here at Microsoft. What's the first thing you do? You go and look to see, am I in a box in the org chart? And right, is this person still here? And this person still here?
Yeah.
And it's a sell. It's a marketing and it's a sell thing. You know, it's that organizational change management and adoption of change. IT people like to enforce changes onto the service, the consumers of their services, but don't change their tools because, or their infrastructure, because they don't like it, right? Because it's like, it's change, right? Yep. It's hard to keep up with it because it changes so quickly.
So if you, now a lot of our listeners, we know from some of the messages we get on Twitter are, you know, IT managers, architects and the like. If there's one of them sitting out there today and she wants to go to the cloud, she wants to move her business unit to the cloud, what are some of the things that she should be thinking about right off the bat?
Okay, well, the first is to start with the why. And I don't know if most of you, is there's a great TED talk, Simon Sinek, S-I-N-E-K. Start with the why. I would recommend anybody, whether you're in IT or not, start with the why. Is you got to start that vision of why is it important that we're moving to the cloud and start building that momentum, right? You need to do that internal marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm sure there's lots of people out there that are IT pros that are like, I'm so done managing stuff that's broken. I want to do really cool stuff now. Like, I want to work in automation. You know, I want to be managing further up the stack versus, you know, blinking lights and racking and jacking servers and, you know, deploying OSs and everything else like that. Is really understanding that message, what's in it for me, you know, what is it going to mean for my career doing that? Like, you guys made a change in your career. Come on. Where were you 5 years ago? Where were
Azure.
You? Come on, Evan. You were not.
I was in Azure.
You were not in Azure 5 years ago. You were dreaming about Azure.
Absolutely, actually,
you weren't
I was.
In it.
No, I helped. So this is actually not, and it's a, I'm a ringer for this because I was on the beta team for SQL Azure before it was SQL Azure, and then helped, you know, help launch SQL Azure and was, you know, the lead EE for SQL Azure, and then I moved over to Azure IaaS when we shipped Azure IaaS. So yeah, I've been doing it since 2008.
Wow. Okay. Sorry.
I definitely don't have that kind of background in Azure like Evan has. I was more of a traditional, you know, .NET developer. And I still do that, but now I've adapted to the cloud. Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, like 5 years ago, I was the queen of System Center Service Manager, right? So, you know, I even wrote an MS Pressbook on that, right? So, you know, same focus. But it's like a lot of times it's like, you know, we're moving at such a rapid pace in technology. And with clawbacks and training, I don't know. I always believe I'm drinking from a fire hose. Like, there's just so much I need to do and so much I need to learn. But sometimes if I just focus on the outcome versus the bits and pieces of that's how it's going to get there, because with my network of smart buddies, like you too, of course, they're my network of smart buddies, you can help me piece everything together, right, mm-hmm. at the end of the day. But I really, truly believe if you don't address the people or the organizational change management when they move the cloud, it won't work. Right? Because this whole thing is like, when we move apps, we recommend customers to take, like, we're moving one service or application to Azure. It's like, let's make a small center of excellence in your organization just to manage that, right? To operate it, move it forward. And then as you bring on other applications, you would use that center of excellence to help with the transition of the employees from on-premise to moving to that new center of excellence. Like, we're starting to, like, a feeder system. We're bringing people in. Because, you know, you can't have one person focused on just on-premise, and then they have to go and move and manage a cloud service. It's, the idea is, like, this is new. This is where we're moving it to, and we're going to do it, you know, step by step. And we're here to support you.
Got it. And I know you also mentioned some work in DevOps that you've been doing. Is there something you can share with our listeners in that area?
Yeah, so, you know, I have my ITIL expert. I'm actually a certified ITIL trainer, and I'm not a big fan of ITIL by any means, because it tells me a lot about what I'm going to do, but it doesn't tell me how to do it. Now, one of the biggest challenges with DevOps, and a lot of people will say it's a fad, and it's a plug out there. I'm in New Orleans at the DevOps Summit presenting on, you know, is DevOps a fad? We have a really good story around this at Microsoft, and, you know, as more as we embrace open source, but we actually shifted from, like, doing those big changes, you know, in service packs and, you know, moving to more of an update roll-up cadence and lighting things up in update roll-ups versus waiting for a service pack or a new release. And it's really about fostering an organization about trust, because the chasm between development and operations is wide, and they hate each other, right? Mm. Come on. You guys were talking to two guys that possibly you hated each other 10 years ago, right? You probably wouldn't even speak to each other, right? And it's about the shift of the accountabilities, like moving in. It's like, as you move, you know, applications, it's like the person who wrote the code should support the code versus the infrastructure person having to support the code. So when we started talking about DevOps, we've got some great tools, we've got some great capabilities in Azure, but it's really that cultural shift of, you know, fostering that, you know, trust. Like, you sit down with an infrastructure person, it's like when the application or dev team releases an application, they will ensure that when they ship an application that we've done instrumentation and telemetry to actually monitor and capture issues, that when the thing breaks in the middle of the night, they're going to be called and they're going to be up there helping you support it, right? Because mm-hmm. we all know this in the past, but it's really about shifting the thing. Is like, you know, it's not about throwing things over to operations, and operations is just a bunch of people that are going to run it. Is that, you know, development is part of the operations in the steady state and the support phase. And that takes a shift, right? Because it actually improves the really capability of developers. They want to write code now that's not going to break in production because they don't want to wake up in the middle of the night to support it.
Right. But how is that?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, just I was trying to envision that from a team layout perspective. So if our architect out there is planning to build out a team to build this, you know, to build this new service, would there be a dedicated person in that development team that focuses on the DevOps side, or does everybody participate in DevOps?
I think everybody participates in DevOps. 4 years ago, are you familiar with our RAP as a service offering through Premier?
Say that again.
The water service.
RAP as a service.
Oh yeah.
So it's a risk and assessment platform. We moved it 5 years ago to being completely on premise, everything, and we moved it into Azure, right? And then we moved the whole state of how we're going to actually develop, right? And it was a big change for us when I worked in Premier, back in Premier, is like now the developers actually had to support their code. And we had to, we were starting to support, like we have one for SQL, we have one for Active Directory, IIS, you know, System Center, Operations Manager, Service Manager, Config Manager, right? We have all of these things to do, but we're now building on a platform within Azure, right? So it went from, you know, initially when I was talking to this team internal to Microsoft, they're like, well, we're hiring an ops guy. I'm like, I actually did a presentation to the general manager and I actually had a picture of a guy with a Superman shirt on, like big ass, right? Because mm-hmm. I said, I don't know how one person's going to solve all the issues with code. I said, the idea is like, you have to shift it. And these people are responsible for code, you know, managing the code and orchestrate, you know, doing the instrumentation, orchestration, and automation with it. And that was a huge shift, and it was not easy. It was not easy. Like, when we first launched, we struggled with it because these people were like, well, I ship code, and that's all I do, right? I throw it over.
Mm-hmm.
People manage it. But then they started getting, like, the, we were using Ops Manager with an early version of the Azure Management Pack in there, and they're starting to get, like, hit. with alerts, like it's like you got to address that. So, you know, and we leveraged an outward customer facing tool and with notifications, and they were being notified. It's like, wow, maybe next time I'm going to write it a little better, because we only actually had one ops person, but we had 15 devs, right? So that's a complete different ratio,
right? You know,
back in the day, it's like, you know, we started leveraging Azure. There was only about three things on premise in Microsoft that we had staging service. And that's when we're doing that continuous integration, right? And to continuous deployment into production on Azure. That was all, he only really managed three VMs. That's why we only need one person. But we had multiple devs, right?
Right.
And that ratio shift. Right, because back in the day, we would have like a ton of people in operations and like one or two devs. You know, the accountability shift is like, hey, you write code, you need to manage your code, you need to respond to your code. And we did have, like, I'm not saying it was beautiful, because it was really.
It's a tough shift. Yeah, it's tough.
And.
All right, so
there's a great thing that they say in the Office 365 team, and they said anything manual that they do is considered a bug. That's an interesting way to think about things.
So automate everything, basically. Okay.
Automate, instrument, monitor. Anything that they do manually is considered a bug because they obviously didn't consider it. So, Sujit, you were about to say something.
No, I was going to say, we've got two very good points for our listeners to consider, right? One is that they should ask why they're going into this cloud business, why they want to move their stuff to the cloud, and then tackle the whole DevOps thing head on. Make sure that that's front and center, because I think these are two of the I would say the biggest pain points that anyone would face trying to move an application to the cloud.
It is. You know, there's a great, like, I follow some really great people on Twitter. Like, one is being one of our very own guys, David Tesar, T-E-S-A-R. He's on Twitter, Volker Will. They're a couple of my favorite people. But I think a lot of things is just, you know, reading about it. Because, you know, DevOps is not a destination, right? I don't go to being DevOps. It's the journey and it's the cultural shift. So you think about, there's no one right way to do DevOps, but it's a shift in the accountabilities and responsibilities. It's fostering a relationship of trust between, you know, operations and developers. And again, that toxic chasm that's, you know, been there since the beginning of the mainframe, right? We all hated each other. And the idea is understanding is like just doing increments and saying, you know, are we getting better? Are we able to, you know, foster faster releases into production? You know, are we able to shorten our time to market? You know, are we gaining better market share? And I think that's really, even when we talk about cloud and DevOps, is focusing more on the outcomes and not necessarily shining the light on all those internal metrics. Like, if you can measure your internal metrics against the business outcomes, I think you'd be more successful, as opposed to looking at, you know, the blips on the screen.
Right, right. Or the next shiny thing to come onto the cloud. Great. Wow. Thanks. That's some very good insight, I must say. I hadn't thought about these things in the way you presented it. Makes a lot of sense to me. Sure, our listeners got a lot out of that as well. Thank you so much for spending your evening with us. And we appreciate all the information you've given our listeners. We hope to have you back on the show sometime when you're done with all your world tours and speaking engagements and things like that.
Yeah, well, no, it was an absolute honor. Thank you very much for reaching out to me. And as I said, there's a lot more than just the technology. And it's like, we need to consider the people and the processes in order to be successful to moving to Azure. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.